Tom Blanchard.
Here.
Kazoo. Okay. I don't know how to pronounce it. I apologize. The Tories, either one. Bill Barnett.
I'm here.
Tom or Kathy.
Hello. Hi.
Hi, Tom. I got your email. Thanks. John,
thank you.
There. Sarah Joe. Dan's not going to make it.
Sarah Joe is going to be late.
Going to join late.
Bill and Dale are here. And anyone I miss?
And we can see Bill and Dale and John.
Yeah. So Christy Petranco, Cristiano, Claire Coles, Mike Charnas.
Christiana's here. Hi, how's your name? Just turn in.
Hi. All right. Okie doke. So I guess we can move on. Michael's the first item on the agenda, so we'll wait for Michael to join us before we take that up. Bill, do you want to go into the discussing the face-to-face meeting? And as all of you know, we had a difficult time getting dates, and so it's going to be February 6th, which is the day after Super Bowl Sunday.
Fifth and sixth.
Right. And so it's going to be our sleeping rooms will be at the Hilton Rockville. We're trying to negotiate with the hotel to either meet there, and if that doesn't work out, we'll meet at the NIAAA Terrace Room. And Jill will be sending out more information about arrivals and departure dates, etc. Anything else to add on that, Jill?
No, that's great. Just if you want to start booking your travel, we will probably not adjourn until 3 p.m. on Tuesday, so you typically want to look for flights after 5 p.m., and then we'll start the meeting right away Monday morning. So that's all I have about flight info.
Yeah, and I'd if we're going to go till 3, I'd try to get as close to 6 as possible, since at that time of the day, it may take a little bit longer to get to the airport. Okay.
Hey, Ed.
Yeah.
Ed, would you like Dale and I to think about potential speakers to invite? I don't know how packed the agenda is, but we might have some local speakers that may be of interest.
Yeah, and we had talked about someone who might be able to talk on the data sharing policy and ethics involved in that. Someone from NIH who's familiar might be able to answer questions about the data sharing and the repository and how to deal with getting data up there. I think that's something that a lot of people had questions about. So
all right, we'll think about that.
Okay.
Ed, I just want to say it's Michael and I'm on.
All right, so you're the first item on the agenda.
All right.
An update on symposia.
So we have, as of probably this afternoon, UK time, an outline of the RSA symposium, and I will still have to create a narrative to link all these things together, but Scott Parnell will begin with a presentation of his work on ciliopathy, and we will connect that to the work that Mike Studdy published in Acer and continues to do, looking at hypertelorism, which is a shared feature with the ciliopathies. In addition, Joanne Weinberg will present her work on cytokines from the human cohort that Tina has, looking at the predictive value of cytokines that are collected during pregnancy on outcomes. And Tina will present the work that she has on growth and growth deficiency is a predictor of cognitive and other outcomes. Again, I'll stitch that all together. For ISBRA, we're looking at a focus on genetics, and for this, Scott and Johan will separately present their linked work looking at screening both zebrafish and mice, and I guess to recapitulate some of the discoveries that have already been made, where candidate genes have been identified in the zebrafish model and in cellular models that I will present that have allowed genetic studies in the CFAS cohort to show that candidate genes, in fact, can be successfully nominated and identified using some of these models. So the proposal there would be for Scott and Johan and myself to present the sort of molecules, cells, and model systems nomination process, and that Tina will present the genetic work that she will have completed by September. And again, these have all come together in literally the last hours, so I haven't been able to let everybody know who I said tentatively we might include, but that's more or less the outline.
Okay. Anyone have any other issues related to either the RSA or ISBRA or the European meeting? There will be travel money available for the Kyoto meeting, so it helps to defray some of the expenses and doesn't cover everything. But so if people are interested in going, you should let me know. And if typically it's to people who are presenting in symposia, not just poster presentations.
Ed, do we know when the deadline is for that?
They typically start, and I haven't received anything. I know that they've started to invite plenary speakers, but that's about it. Okay, all right. Any other questions about the symposia or RSA meeting or whatever?
Ed, it's Joanne. So just remind me what is happening with the Vancouver CFAS presentation. I guess we don't have an official one, or?
We don't at this.
Okay, yeah, okay. I'm actually on one with Claire and Therese Grant.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I know they put one in on the Doha type of stuff. So,
yeah, we did that.
All right, but no, I think it's the other one that we're asked to present the half-day symposium, every other year one.
Yeah. It's a national meeting, right.
Yeah. All right, Jill. On the screen, I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that the publications that came out in the last month were two of them. I think there were two there. Julie Cable and Claire Coles on her FNIR study. And the other one, further down on your screen, was one out of Mike Jarnas' lab. So that's what came out in the last month here. So I think that's great news. And now, Jill, everybody was asked to suggest ways that progress on their individual projects could be tracked. We received things from everybody. We had a conference call to discuss them, and we've come up with some suggestions or ideas or other ways of looking at it, since there was a large variety of ways to track the data that were suggested. And so Jill has kind of put together a small slide project on what we're kind of looking for, and maybe you can revise the procedures that you originally sent to us based upon these suggestions. Pull yours, Jill.
Okay, so thank you again to everyone who submitted the drafts for the tracking of the CFAS-4 progress. And again, after, as Ed said, we held a meeting and we looked at them as a whole. And after looking at them as a whole, we thought that we would provide these suggestions to try and make them more streamlined. So again, the goal of these progress tracking documents, which will be shared on a monthly basis and updated via a Google Docs spreadsheet, is to make sure that we're all getting to the finish line together in 5 years. And while there were lots of awesome details and step-by-steps that were displayed in the drafts that we received, we want to make sure that we're focusing on the data and the samples. We want to be focusing on the measurables that will lead to the publications. So the subjects, the samples, we're not as interested in the minutiae like hiring and getting this step to this step. So not all the rungs in the ladder, just kind of the overall, is it completed or not? And again, as we've said multiple times, the goal is not micromanagement. It's just to be able to kind of see where especially the shared samples are and where they need to go and where people are on their recruitment and tested lines. So that being said, we want everyone to take two and to put their draft into a spreadsheet format that will focus on what was promised and how it's being delivered and to include the collaboration details. The table or chart should quantify each deliverable and be visually simple and easy to point to progress. So when we look at these every month, it should be clear to us what happened, what needs to happen, and how can we help or what help is needed from other collaborators to reach your goal. You should clearly state any kind of flowchart items for shared samples and keep it clean and clear. As simple in text and as less words as possible is always easy when looking at visuals, so eliminate redundancies when possible, and again, we don't need to see every step. So, that being said, I kind of just
Jill, before you go on?
Yep.
What do you mean by collaboration details? What's included in that?
So, that would be like an example where I'm collecting tissue samples, and I need to get those tissue samples to X by X so they can run analysis by this date. So just kind of showing the supply chain, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Right. And progress so, in that regard. Right.
Yep. And so I'm going to show some examples of kind of, I just took some random things. So this would be like a regular chart of showing you're going to recruit these amount of people by this time, you're going to test these amount of people by this time and by group, and kind of putting it into a format with goals for each of those timelines. So this is kind of like what we did last time. So this would be an example of kind of a recruitment and testing table. That doesn't work for everyone, so I provided some other examples as well. And these are just jumping off points. You can make them different, but the goal is to just kind of make them all Excels. So this would be a Jones draft example, maybe, for all the dysmorphology exams he does by site, and then the telemedicine exams. So for his, it's not always just collected or not collected. He has different sites he's collecting, and that's important because if he needs someone to make appointments for him to see more subjects in a certain site, this would help with that. So this is just an example of kind of a multi-site table. And then another thing that we were talking about is whether or not samples are completed or not. So this could be an example where it's just a yes, no, is it completed? So not everything is going to have a month-by-month goal. Some of the things are just going to be, is it done or not done? So these are just pulled out of a hat kind of examples. The Tories need to establish a profiling method. Is that done? What date does it need to be done by? That kind of an example. Same with the data dictionary for a certain project. Another thing would be, for instance, a basic science kind of experiment, where is your litter in the process of all the things you said you're going to do? So again, I just kind of took a stab, and this would kind of be a spreadsheet version of like a double arrow kind of visualization, just showing what date you need each thing done by and how many are actually done. Another example would be kind of what Dr. Hannigan was asking about, like a shared sample. So if Tina's collecting samples in the Ukraine on non-exposed mother-infant pairs, how many of has been done? How many of those have been shipped to Weinberg? How many of those have been analyzed by Weinberg? It's kind of showing the chain of what's happening to that CFAS sample. Another thing would be, what is someone doing for someone else? So in Vancouver, they're collecting 2D photos, which are going to be helpful to Dr. Hammond's project, but they're being put up through Dr. Farood's portal. So just kind of showing where everything's at so that everyone knows kind of where they're at and everything, if that makes sense. And then the last example I put together was just kind of showing, again, another way of showing a shared sample. And this is completely detailed, and you probably wouldn't need all of this, but like the sample's recruited, the sample's collected, the sample's shipped, the sample's received, the sample's analyzed. So just kind of showing it in that way and putting the names of people. So I know that was a lot of examples, and I'm going to send these out to everyone because, again, these are just examples. How you do it is up to you, but just kind of putting it more of an Excel format where everyone can just look at it cleanly. Ed, Bill, Dale, does that kind of hit on the things we talked about?
Yeah, I think it does.
Okay.
Again, it's not for us to micromanage, but it's for everyone to, I guess, understand where all the projects are in relationship to one another at a given time.
Yeah.
One question I would throw out there, Jill, is I don't know if we ever discussed logistics. Whether the PIs were going to be going in and updating them on a monthly
yep.
basis, or were they?
That's my last slide. Okay. So that, I just wanted comments on the picture or the examples real quick, and then also to share just some overall concerns and comments that were brought up when we were analyzing these, is just to kind of really look at your project, and a lot of you are still testing and collecting samples in year 5, and just to kind of do what you can to move up that timeline because you want to make sure that your information, and especially the information that people are relying on you to get their project moving forward, is done as best it can be prior to year 5 so that there are publications that could impact the next renewal. And then we kind of already talked about the second bullet point here, that for projects relying on sample coordination and collaboration, just to make it clear who needs what from whom and by what date. And so while you will not be including every step in your CFAS progress tracking spreadsheet, you can always notify Ed of any roadblocks you encounter, and he can help to devise the best plan to troubleshoot that with the assistance of the advisory committee. So just because we're not asking for, you know, did you get this from this person, if you're having a problem, that's always what the advisory committee and Ed are here to help with. So what should we do next?
Jill, can I ask you a question first?
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So, and I don't know if Sarah's on, so this is Tatiana. So I guess I'm curious how to handle one thing. So I know for my project, a lot of year one is getting the website set up for us to be able to do online recruiting. And I think that's what leads to what I think is probably the descriptive part that we're trying to get away from. So once we start collecting, then I'm very confident I can give you lovely numbers for years 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Right.
How do you want us to do metrics? Because I think Sarah probably has the same thing, like for her FONS piece at least. How do you want us to do that? And if you want me to do it offline with you, I'm fine. I just wasn't sure.
No, we actually discussed yours, and I think yours would fall into the category of completed or not completed. So it could be something and however you want to break it down. Like, I know you have to set up video consent. So maybe you have a checklist or, you know, a line for each video consent completed or instructions for how to complete 2D photographs complete, you know, which thing you need help with from each person. But, you know, obviously you're going to have more of a yes-no situation rather than number of subjects in the portal because there won't be any yet. But that will be something that will be easy to track moving forward. But just kind of quantifying it into a way where if you need input from someone else, you're getting it. Or does that make sense?
Totally does. I just wanted to know which model to use in that case. That was really helpful. Thank you.
Okay. So what's next? Take another stab at it and send me your table or charts in a Excel format by December 6th. And then I'll move them all into one spreadsheet with a tab for each project or maybe a tab for each sample. So it will be different based on each. As you can see, it's not as clear this time what belong is the wrong word. There will be some things where it's not going to make sense for it to be under a tab called Farood. It's going to make more sense for it to be in a tab called Web Portal. Does that make sense?
Yes, totally
so just send them to me and I'll clear them up in that way. And again, how we'll move forward with it once they're all complete is the PI or a designated project staff will be responsible then for updating the information just like they were last time on the Monday before the monthly meeting. And then it will go into the Google document. So the rest of the information on here is just logistics about how to access Google Drive, and I'll email those out to you separately. So that's kind of our two cents on moving forward with that. And we're all here for any questions. So that's it.
And again, it when we had our conference call about this, it wasn't to micromanage. And so, you know, we know everybody needs to hire people. We know that people need to train people. Subcontracts have to be established, things like that. But we're really only interested in the deliverable parts of it. What's going to result in hard data that then is going to be able to be published? Not the nitty-gritty about how you have to run your project from a, just a daily point of view. That make sense?
Yes.
All right.
Yep.
Dale or Bill, any other comments? You were on the call.
I mean, an obvious place for people to start would be to go back and see what their what they proposed in their applications. I mean, we did that as we were reviewing some of these templates you know, a lot of the stuff that's in those applications, you know, could just be adjusted and put into a table format.
Yeah, sure,
so.
Yeah, problem.
And thanks to Jill for leading this effort.
Yeah, she's been incredible in this, so thanks, Jill. Someone said something. I heard someone speaking, but I didn't pick up who it was. Did anyone have any other comments? Nope. Okay. All right. So
it's going to be particularly interesting to see the recruitment of virtual participants through the portal, since this is a new activity for us.
I agree with you, and I think there's just from our end, it just takes some time to get it set up. So we now have, I mean, we're having weekly meetings for each of the different parts. I just worried about how do I show you that things are moving, and that yes, no, at least from my perspective. And I would say for that kind of a thing, that's publishable in other realms as well. Just being able to do that and how you set that up will be. So that is kind of a publication that can come out of the first year with that development. But that's probably unusual for that kind of a project. Most projects, I don't think, could publish that.
That's a very good point. That, you know, especially if you're developing new processes, that you know, do consider, you know, how that can be turned into a publication. Very good point.
All right, Jeff has the WebEx presentation for today, so if we can turn over the screen to Jeff. That would.
Okay, so I click share my screen. And, all right, are you seeing my title screen here?
Got it.
Yes.
All right, perfect. And in terms of time, Ed, do we have other pressing things today?
Just
or
the project updates and comments by the SAB.
Okay.
So,
all right, onward. So I'm going to give a...
20 minutes, all right? Can you do it?
Sure, yeah. So I'm going to give an update on the neuroimaging project, just where we are with our startup, and focus a little bit more on the data analysis that are continuing from phase 3. So the new project, there's the plan. We're going to be recruiting groups of 45. So it's 45 alcohol exposed and 45 controls. And we're going to do that in the first 3 years of the project in order to allow the 15-month follow-up to fit in with the 5-year time frame. So these are going to be 10 to 16-year-olds, and all of them are going to receive a number of things, dysmorphology being one. So Ken Jones is going to make regular pilgrimages to Minneapolis. We're going to be doing MRI scans with each of these individuals, and we're going to be doing about a 3-hour neurocognitive slash behavioral session with the kids. And this is including Dr. Masson's relatively short digital battery, which is all going to be done on iPads and or electronically, including the behavioral questionnaires for the parents and the neuropsych tests for the kids themselves. So we've gotten that down to the point where we're going to do both of those in one visit. Then essentially what we do is we have Ken see a collection of these kids once we have batched them, and that's worked pretty well in the past. There's a 15-month interval built into this. Sounds a little bit precise, but we're going to do MRI scans at 15 months. The reason that we're going with the 15-month interval is that we have matched our imaging protocol to another study that is going on of using the Human Connectome Project, which I'll talk about. But there are more than 1,000 kids who are being seen as part of that project, and they're going to be seen at a 15-month interval. So we will essentially be able to take our fetal alcohol data. We're going to be able to do our comparisons against the control group, for which we will have all of our measures, and they'll be matched. But then we'll also be able to put the fetal alcohol group against this backdrop of these more than 1,000 kids and teenagers and use that as sort of a normative database. So that's the reason for the 15-month interval. So the progress on this has, I think, been steady. We have two new coordinators hired. Their names are Mariah and Priya. They've already been to San Diego to train on Sarah's battery, and they have been working to get that up and running. It's ready to go. We have our neuroimaging protocol finalized and tested. We're probably going to be running that on two or three different scanners that are identically matched here. So that's going to give us some flexibility. They're all in the same facility, but that should allow us to really run scans when we need to. We have just secured the IRB approval. That was a long process because our university moved recently to an electronic IRB submission. And we've just sent out a first batch of recruitment letters and are going to be following up with calls. So we're well underway there. And we just had a local conference. Actually, Ken and Tina were both at that conference, and that was a couple hundred families in the Twin Cities area, so we did some recruitment there as well. So we expect our first participants to have their heads in the MRI machine sometime this month. In terms of data analysis, these are the papers that have come out of the Phase 3 MRI studies, and these are a variety. The first one is from our group here in Minnesota. The second one is from Elizabeth's group. That's Christina Eubin. And the third one is, the third one is from Sarah's group. And this is on neural correlates of memory in youth with PAE. So these are the three that are currently published with the most recent data from Phase 3. And then I heard a dial tone. Am I still on, or did somebody else disappear?
Yep. You're
okay.
There.
You guys are there.
You're there.
All right. So these are the papers that I know of that are currently under review. Both of these have been through one round. One of these is our paper, and the other one is Elizabeth's paper. So these are both under revision right now, and I anticipate probably both of these being published relatively soon. I'm going to focus on this one in the first couple slides. So this is a paper that just came out earlier this year on cortical gyrification in the CFAS-3 sample. This came out in Neuroimage Clinical. And this is the basic process that we looked at in this paper. We're going to be continuing with some of this work as well, so I'll go into a little bit of detail on this and then skip over some of the detail on some of the other ones. The idea with this method is to get a measure of the amount of curvature in the cortex. And the basic understanding is that there are developmental conditions that affect the curvature of the cortex, and that result in a smoother than normal brain, and that this obviously has some implications for cognitive functioning. So there are very intricate processes that kind of trigger and regulate this folding process. So there are automated procedures now, semi-automated procedures, that will allow you to measure the level of gyrification all across the entire cortex. And if you look at the figure on the left, you see that there's a dotted line. I don't believe you can see my cursor, can you?
Yep.
Yes, you can.
You can see that. Okay. So the dotted line is essentially a surface marker across the cortex. And then if you look at the solid line on the cortex there, it's following the fold. And you're essentially measuring that space or the distance between those two points to get this index of gyrification. Pretty simple measure, but when you have to inflate the cortex in order to do this, and I mean that in a computer way, not literally, but you inflate the cortex and you measure all these points, and then you create these maps like you see on the right side here. So it's essentially a heat map of thickness or of gyrification. So here's what some of the data look like from CFAST 3. This was a combination of data that came from all four sites, LA, San Diego, Atlanta, and Minneapolis. And we were able to process all that data in a way that can combine it. These are kids who are aged 9 to 16. We had 92 with prenatal alcohol exposure and 83 were controls. And these are clusters that come out of the analysis after controlling for things like sight and the age of the child and the overall head size, head circumference, as well as gender in this case. So you do see some sight differences with a measure like this because the instrumentation differs, so you have to control for that. But that basically allows us to combine all of this data after spending a fair amount of time kind of whipping it into shape. And these are clusters of difference. And, of course, all this stuff is controlled for family-wide error rate because you're looking at lots of individual points here. But these are the surviving clusters, and the clusters themselves are not so important. What essentially is important here is that there are large regions of the cortex where there are significant differences between those with prenatal alcohol exposure and those who are in the control group. The difference being that those with PAE have smoother cortices. This is in the table form. You see some of the numbers behind this, and I just focused your attention by drawing a blue box around the size of some of these clusters. So we're talking about a large number of vertices or points on the cortex where we're seeing these differences. And if you look at the significance levels, you can see that, you know, even after controlling for this is Monte Carlo controlled, these are significant findings across the cortex. So does it have any meaning? This is John Hannigan is hovering over my figure on my screen here.
I'm not doing anything.
It just looks funny. So what we have here is these are correlation maps. And so on the left you see that this is significance of straightforward Pearson correlations between the gyrification at any one point on the cortex and the child's IQ. And so the yellow and red areas indicate high correlation. The figure on the right at the top, the graph, is showing you just straight scatter plots. So what is the relationship between overall, if we average across all of the points in the cortex, this gyrification and IQ, you see that there's a pretty clear relationship there. You see the clustering of those with alcohol exposure a little bit in the lower IQ range and the smaller values in terms of cortical gyrification, and a pretty decent correlation there. So we think that this has meaning. And I'll come back to why, how we want to kind of use this in the future scenario.
Jeff, is there a difference in the relationship between the PAE and the control?
We did look at that, and there, the correlation is there for both groups. And I, to be honest, I can't remember if there was an actual difference in the level of the, those correlations, but there definitely was a relationship in both groups. It,
okay.
My guess is it's probably stronger in the control group. We see more scatter and more variety in the alcohol group, but there still was a relationship there.
Thank you.
Okay, so there we go. So now we are going to move into, we have been moving into the area of longitudinal analysis. So we have two time points from CFAST-3, and those were 2 years apart. For that data, we have 58 people with prenatal alcohol exposure and 52 controls. They were a little wider age range, 6 to 17. You see the four sites there, and we are starting to look at the measures of cortex in this group of kids. I'm going to talk about a measure of change that's called symmetrized percent change. This is essentially just taking the two time points and kind of coming up with a standardized measure of change between those two time points. And so what we're looking at in these maps are that symmetrized percent change over the 2 years, and we asked a specific question here about what was the relationship between that change and the age of the individuals being examined. So we wanted to know, was there a difference in the rate of change in the cortex depending on between PAE and controls, and did that depend on the child's age? So in other words, is there something abnormal going on in PAE, and is it different at different ages? Does it accelerate in adolescence or show up more in the younger kids? That's essentially the question. And what we found here so far in looking at the thickness, the volume, and the gyrification is something like the thickness changes. We saw greater change in the PAEs and the controls at older ages. So the change is essentially thinning across the board as the cortex develops, but the PAE group was showing a higher level of change at older ages. So that's that interaction I was talking about with age. With LGI, the gyrification, we see basically the same thing, that there's something atypical about the development. But in this case, the development is increasing curvature normally, and we see less of that going on in those with PAE. So this is sort of the first look at the developmental pattern and how the developmental pattern of these abnormalities plays out over the time spans that we're able to study these kids. This is complicated, but this is just to show you that we are still working with the diffusion data. So the previous slides I was talking about are coming from anatomical MRIs. We're just looking at the structure. With these methods here on this slide, we're looking at the diffusion properties of the brain. So we're looking at the microstructure, especially in the white matter. And all this is really showing is that having a repeated measures study design and special software that handles the repeated measures really gives you an advantage. So this is Tracula, which is a software tool that allows us to really look at the tracks, the white matter tracks. But it has now provisions inside it that it allows us to do repeated measures analyses without having to just pile everyone together at time one, pile everyone together at time two, and then look at the differences. Here we're actually putting the brain together from time one and time two, and being able to run the repeated measures analysis in the traditional way. So these are what the tracts look like. They look a little bit like chicken fingers when you put them together in this way. But they really allow you to measure the integrity of the white matter at the microstructural level in these very discrete, kind of anatomically correct tracts, which is useful in and of itself. But when you put that together with two time points, it becomes pretty powerful because you're lining everything up from time one to time two in such a way that you really reduce the error variance a lot. These are myelin maps, so this is another thing that we are doing brand new in CFAST 4. We have some techniques using the human connectome stream that allows us to look at specifically at myelin and to calculate levels of myelination here. I'll just point out these are images of typically developing individuals, and you can see that the heavily myelinated regions in red here are those involving sensory motor. That's just in this particular image, but you get the point that it allows you to do a voxel by voxel analysis of what's happening with myelin. And of course, doing that twice will be very interesting, especially in the adolescent age range, and especially given that we have these more than 1,000 kids who we're going to be able to compare against that backdrop with this. This will be a quick slide. This is just showing you, if you look at the images where the brain is segmented in this very funny way, these are examples of segmentation that you can do with the human connectome processes, and these, rather than just dividing the brain up based on gyri or sulci or some kind of atlas, this actually allows you to break up the brain using a combination of anatomy and microstructure and even function. So you can really start to break up things in a much more sophisticated way, and that will really allow us to look at development in different ways than we've done before. Multi-shell, I won't spend too much time on this other than to say that with diffusion tensor imaging, which is the technique we've been using for some time and have shown, you know, significant differences in prenatal alcohol exposure, there are some limitations, and especially when the fibers in the brain cross, that causes problems for diffusion tensor imaging. So some of these methods, which we will be able to do with our data, allow us to look at the first one is NODI, which has to do with neurite orientation, and the second one is diffusion kurtosis imaging. So this really uses a different mathematical model to show us what's happening with the fibers. So here's an example of this, just a comparison between traditional DTI and diffusion kurtosis imaging. And you can see that where you have fibers that are going in all three orientations, it really becomes much more, you can separate out these tracks, and you can visualize the tracks, which means you can measure them much more effectively. So that's going to be super important when it comes to longitudinal work with diffusion data, because it's noisy. And as you get across time, being able to reduce some of that noise will mean that we'll be able to measure change more effectively. So I thought I would end with the kind of the dream. What I would ultimately like to do with all of this data is I tend to be somewhat of a linear thinker, and I want to break this down and use this data to really directly address the challenge of diagnosis and to make this data accessible, usable, and informative, rather than just continuing to look at pictures of what's wrong with the brain. So this is just a sketch to show you kind of what I envision being able to do with some of this data, even with the CFAST-3 data, and then moving into the CFAST-4 data, is to lay out on a subject-by-subject basis where an individual falls on some of these metrics. And so if you imagine, we do this, you know, all the time with the palpebral fissure lengths. You know, we can lay people out and say this one is 2 standard deviations outside of the norm. We can do that with measures like brain volume very easily as well. But my goal is to really push some of these other metrics into this form so we can really start to say which individuals are abnormal on these measures and which are not. I think that will allow us to show some evidence for neurodevelopmental abnormality in the undiagnosable. I know that we're going to have individuals for whom they don't have facial characteristics, And yet we're going to be able to see these abnormalities, you know, in the less than 10th percentile in, on some of these measures. And some of them will be sophisticated measures like myelin development for age. The other thing that I really hope to do is to put these tools in, put these data into a highly accessible manner like this, like you see in terms of percentiles. By individual, and then and allow other researchers to have access to that data. MRI data is unwieldy, and it's challenging, and there's a million decisions that have to get made in order to process it, and one of the things that I hope to do is to produce the data in such a way that other researchers who have questions about diagnosis or trajectories or cognition can really utilize these data without having to think about all of the intricacies of the processing. And I think that that is very doable. So with that, I will stop and see if anyone has any questions.
Any comments, questions?
Jeff, this is...
I have one, Ben. The gyrification data, do you think it, I mean, as a possibility of correlating the changes that Peter might see with his facial imaging?
I was going to ask the same thing, Ed.
Yeah, I think that that is that's an obvious thing that we should be thinking about, and because we're talking about processes that are triggered and that unfold at different times in development and that involve you know, analysis of shape. So, yeah, I absolutely.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking like the primary gyri, they develop fairly early, though, right?
They do, yeah, yeah.
Prenatally and perhaps at similar times to some of the facial features where other secondary gyri might not correlate with those facial features because they're developing later.
Right, right.
So you might be able to even get some indication of a time matrix for effect.
Right.
That's not making sense to me, but it will eventually. So.
Yeah, no, I think it's an excellent idea, and I think that putting some of these metrics, well, there's a lot of different ways to do it, but putting some of these metrics in the form of abnormalities at different time points might help us understand how to do that.
Jeff, when you listed what you...
Go ahead. No, I'm sorry, Tavia.
I would just want to ask, when you were showing the assessments, you didn't have on there that you were doing facial images of the kids at the time points that you were seeing them in CFAST-4, and I guess I just wanted to confirm, precisely for the reason we're discussing right there, the ability to also do analyses of changes in the face and how that could also be mapping with the change in retina. And I just wanted to make sure that you had that as part of the protocol.
Yeah, sorry, I did not include that. We still have the camera, and we still intend to image all these kids, yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Peter, any comments about all that?
Yeah, I was just thinking that maybe putting together summary data of face and brain might be less effective than, you know, doing something a bit earlier before you've done all that pre-processing so that you're using a bit more detail than the summary data. What do you think?
Sure, sure. I think for like some of the principal components type of stuff that you're doing, that, you know, it would make sense to start with an earlier, more raw data that describes the shape of the cortex, for example, as opposed to like the summary data. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Okay.
All right, anything that we can do to facilitate any of that, let me know.
Well, I think I've mentioned this before, that we have the old camera, and it's a large camera. It's on a tripod, and it is in a space that, as any of you in universities know, space is a valuable thing. So if we have some possibility of moving to a smaller camera, we are going to have the population, and we're going to be able to image these kids. So if there's a way to make a priority toward getting a smaller camera, that would be extremely helpful.
Peter, are you now using just a vector camera?
That's the one that we use, yeah, the portable cam field.
Okay,
but
we'll
remember,
have you a camera.
It's not so good with the very young children.
Yeah.
Because of movement, or?
Because of, yeah, cooperation from the child.
But these are older kids, right, Jeff?
Yeah, these are older kids.
They're 10. Yeah,
so
they're 10 enough.
You'll have a camera next week, all right?
Okay.
Solve that problem.
I'd like a boat. If we're just asking for stuff.
We can take care of that as well. There are a number of salvage yachts now coming out of Puerto Rico.
Oh, thank you so very much.
And other places there.
That's not what I had in mind.
Oh, okay. I was looking at those for real, though.
I was going to ask for Super Bowl tickets, but I'm going to be in Washington, D.C.
You are going to be on a plane, so yeah. It'll be good to get out of town that weekend.
My team's not going to be in it, so.
Yeah.
Right, Jill?
I don't have a team anymore.
So not if Detroit can help it.
All my money's on a Brett Favre comeback.
Oh my God.
All right. Any other comments on Jeff's presentation? Thanks, Jeff. It was very nice.
I thought it was terrific, Jeff.
This is Scott. One comment, Jeff. If you're gonna compare faces and brains, in addition to doing cortex, you might also do some subcortical structures too.
That's a good suggestion.
That might be interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I have less experience so far with some of the tools that are used for that, but certainly that the data is going to be high quality and certainly amenable to that kind of analysis for sure.
So I look forward to it.
All right.
Okay. All right, so we have about 5 minutes left, so any fantastic late-breaking results someone needs to talk about? Then, if not, any comments from the Science Advisory Board? John, Sarah, Joe?
No, I have nothing today, but I will tell you that, you know, I am exploring possibilities to nominate for the SAB. And I'd be interested to hear from the investigators as to, what type of talent or expertise that they think ought to be included. And if you just want to send me an email on that, that would be useful.
Yeah.
John,
so far I've gotten, one person has made suggestions, so that's all I've gotten so far.
Okay. Yeah, I sent an email to Ed, but I'll forward it on to you too, John.
Thank you very much.
But I think John asked a critical question, is what type of expertise do we need as well as the individual people.
Yes, even if you don't have a person in mind. Yeah.
Because they don't have to be in the FASD field.
Well, I'm specifically looking outside of that. So.
Yeah. So any ideas, please let us know. Dale, Bill?
We do have to get you some names, Ed. I know for SAB potential SAB members. So we'll work on sending you those, and we can also share them with the other SAB members. Did you want to mention that study? So one study that got some press, I don't know if people have seen it, is a study that came out, looks like it might have come out yesterday, from Derek Lindquist's lab at Ohio State. We don't have the paper in front of us, but essentially he used ibuprofen as a therapeutic in a rat model for binge alcohol third trimester and had demonstrated some improvements on, I think it was memory and learning. in the hippocampus. So, and obviously it has implications for those interested in neuroinflammation. So if you haven't seen it, you may want to, and we haven't read the paper, we just saw press releases come out this morning. And
so, so it's Joanne, this harks back to an old paper of Carrie Randall's where she used aspirin.
Yes,
yes. Attenuated effects long ago before we were, I think she discussed inflammation a bit, but inflammation was a very sub-threshold topic at that time.
Yeah, there's always been a thought that there was oxidative stress associated with the effect.
Yeah, when after Carrie published her, someone else published a paper showing an opposite effect, and it just kind of died at that point.
Yeah.
No one followed up on it. So this is interesting. So let's take a look at that. Also, Jill just sent around a Facebook video, I guess. I've never done Facebook, so I don't know if it's a YouTube or Facebook, but of Michael Charnas on PBS. Talking about his adventure in for 2 weeks in Puerto Rico after the hurricane. So it took a real nice interview with him. So you may want to check that out. Any last comments? I know the publication committee is going to stay on the phone and go from there. All righty. Everybody else, thank you very much. And I'll talk to you next month.
Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, Ed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. All right, so the